Americans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. As our pronouncer told you, this program is supported by listeners, and I'm grateful for your contributions. I want to single out Larry Doors, a monthly contributor to the Peter B. Collins Show. He resides in Costa Rica and, like you, grabs the show online. If you can help, just go to my website, peterbcollins.com. It's hard to say that I am pleased, but I am relieved and on a certain level gratified that there is finally a debate underway since Obama took office about the war in Afghanistan. It's been underway for 8 years now. Thousands of Americans have died. Thousands of Afghans have died. And I think it's very clear what my position is, that I don't think that there is a clear mission. I don't think there is an exit strategy. And I don't think that we will overcome the legacy of history in terms of outsiders able to pacify and dominate Afghanistan. But today we're going to get an interesting perspective. Peter von Achtmaehl, and he's going to help me pronounce his name, A-G-T-M-A-E-L is the final word there, is a... How am I doing, Peter? Peter von Achtmaehl?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
Pretty close? Okay. Yeah. You probably help people nine times a day with that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You have taken some powerful photographs, some of which appeared in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, October 18th of 2009, including the cover portrait of General Stanley McChrystal, who is now in charge of the war in Afghanistan, and a number of powerful photos that we'll describe in a moment. And there is also a more extensive package available online if you just go to newyorktimes.com/magazine. They're currently up there on the homepage. And there is a 3-minute slideshow narrated by Peter that is very interesting and takes you to places that you probably haven't been. And we'll also talk shortly about a new book of photographs with some text that Peter has written called Second Tour, Hope I Don't Die. Peter, first tell us about the circumstances. You and reporter Dexter Filkins most recently were embedded with some American troops in Afghanistan. Tell us when you went in and initially what you observed.
Well, we got there, this is about August 2nd or August 3rd, and immediately got a flight down to Helmand Province with the military, and we spent the first chunk of time in a place called Garmsir, mm-hmm. southern Helmand Province, and it was formerly a British detachment there, a very small one that was embattled, and they really couldn't move too far outside this small base. But with the troop surge that Obama put there, they were able to push a series of 3 companies from this battalion. The battalion was 2-8 down farther south. So the Garmsir District Center had become fairly calm, but the farther south they pushed with the Marines, the more fighting they took. And we eventually pushed down to that southernmost Marine unit, and they were taking contact just about every day.
Mm-hmm. And tell us what kind of quality time you got to spend with General McChrystal and what your impressions are of the man.
Oh, not a whole lot of time. He came down to Helmand one day. He spends a lot of time, it seems, doing what's called battlefield circulation, where he flies around Afghanistan to different points and interviews both the guys at the top and the guys at the middle and the guys at the bottom, trying to get an appraisal of the situation. So we sort of spent about a day shadowing him as he came down to Garmsir, and then a further hour or so with an interview and a portrait session back in Kabul after we finished our embed.
Mm-hmm. And what was your impression? I realize Dexter Filkins wrote the narrative here, and I don't want to step on any of his toes, but you're a photojournalist, and you certainly listen and understand what's going on. So share your impressions with us.
You know, I thought General McChrystal, he was a really impressive guy on many levels. You know, over the course of that interview and our conversations and just listening to him as he talked to the district governor and the local battalion commander, Colonel Cabanis, I mean, he clearly had a rigorous and deep knowledge both of strategy, which is, you know, presumably a given his position as someone who was in the counterinsurgency and covert forces realm for many years, but also you know, this sort of deep respect and knowledge of local customs and ask the right questions. Very few of them military-based, more, you know, how to keep civilian deaths down, what people needed, and how practically it was going to get to them. So, you know, to me, he was an impressive guy.
Well, he certainly does seem to have remarkable sensitivities about the way the American forces are perceived by Afghan natives. And in particular, Filkins describes a video conference with the other NATO commanders where McChrystal dresses down, I think it's a German counterpart, who had called in an airstrike because I think one guy, a guy they were after, ran into a building. And McChrystal seems to be very aware that the use of drones, the use of airstrikes, where there's no human contact and there is often what's called collateral damage, civilians who are killed, and most grossly, it's been wedding parties that have been repeatedly hit, that this is counterproductive and that it will not help us fight the insurgency. It will not help us win the hearts and minds of Afghan people who are not aligned with the Taliban and other forces.
Well, you know, that's absolutely true. For better or for worse, though, it seems like, well, his strategy put more troops on the ground, less airstrikes. The counter-strategy, I know being considered by Washington certainly right now, is the very opposite. More drones and airstrikes and covert operations and less in terms of ground forces, so as to have this clearly defined path out of Afghanistan at some point in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... But, you know, who knows what the right decision is, of course. I mean, something's going to get picked, and only history will tell whether things work out or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things that I consider, and let me ask you to describe for our listeners the conditions that you found. Daytime temperatures as high as 130 degrees, a landscape that is rugged and unforgiving. And there are counterinsurgency experts who say that in order to really control Afghanistan, we would need upwards of 600,000 American or NATO and American troops there over a sustained period of time.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing that I certainly can't comment on, you know, with any degree of accuracy. But I can tell you some anecdotes from my own experience. Dexter and I went down basically to a place called Mian Poshte, which is in southern Helmand province. We really wanted to see the tip of the spear, where the Marines had pushed out the farthest and what they were seeing and what they were encountering. And what we had there was a very traditional culture that really had nothing in common with, you know, with the U.S. Marines or even the other Afghan forces that were there. And there certainly weren't many Afghan forces, but they didn't even speak the same language. They're Pashto speakers down in Helmand. A lot of the Afghan forces were from the east, from Kunar, Nuristan. And so there was this disconnect with the local population and the military there. The local population, on the other hand, did have a lot in common with the Taliban coming through, who were also Pashto speakers. They were shared traditional and similar religious values, and their way of life was just about the same. So, well, the while the villagers there weren't particularly happy one way or another to have any military forces there, I mean, they just really wanted to be left alone to farm their land, they were giving tacit support to the Taliban. They really had no choice but to give tacit support to the Taliban. So basically, as soon as we would go more than maybe a kilometer outside this outpost we were stationed at called Cop Sharp, named for a Marine who had died in the initial assault, we would get into a firefight or we'd get blown up by an IED, you know, I'd say about 75% of the time. And apparently those numbers were on the low side. They had units that were taking contact 90% of the time. They were leaving the wire.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find in terms of morale among the American troops that you were embedded with and talked to?
Oh, pretty high, at least to a couple of reporters, certainly. A lot of these Marines, there seemed to be sort of a shift. I remember when I first started going to Iraq in 2006, I was with a lot of different units that had seen a couple tours there already at that point. And 2006 was a really deadly year, and those guys were just about fed up at that point. They were very open with their frustrations with the war and the way they were allowed to conduct it. This Marine unit, on the other hand, that we were with was almost universally young soldiers. I think they'd had a real shift from a lot of the guys that had done a few tours, 3-4 tours, getting out, and a whole new crop had come in. Some of them had done one tour to Iraq the previous year where absolutely nothing had happened because now Western Al-Anbar province has become completely stable. So they were generally, they were pretty excited in a lot of ways. You know, Marines, a lot of the time they go there, you know, they want to fight. They want to prove themselves under fire. So while they were getting a little bit tired of getting shot at nearly every day, morale was pretty darn good.
Well, and in the slideshow that people can get at the New York Times website, you describe this one group of fighters who hadn't had a hot meal in 6 weeks.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they were this place, Cop Sharp, was completely disconnected from the Marine service line, and so they had convoys going down there periodically, but two out of three were getting hit by IEDs. So they were really only sending down essential supplies.
Mm-hmm.
So what ended up happening was that they were just forced to eat MREs, basically meals ready to eat, which are just, you know, you pour a little water into a bag that's got a heater in it. You heat up something that, you know, it's all basically a variation of meatballs and tomato sauce. I mean, they're pretty simple meals. And that was the nature of their existence. And they would sleep on the floor, and they would leave the wire every day and get shot at and shoot back. So it was a simple life in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, describe some of the interactions between American troops and Afghan civilians, because in one sequence, again in the slideshow, there is an Afghani who surfaces and says there are Taliban lying in wait just a little ways up the road here. And the American commander of this group is saying, well, he's a little suspicious. This could be a ruse. So what is the level of trust between the Americans on patrol and the Afghans they encounter?
Well, at this point in Mian Poche, certainly, there's very little trust on either side. The Marines had arrived there 6 weeks before in this air assault, and there hadn't been any military presence there for the rest of the war. So the Afghans were extremely wary of the Marines, especially given that the Taliban basically lived all around them. I mean, there was one day where we went on a foot patrol to the nearest village about a kilometer away, and a massive roadside bomb buried in the road exploded on our foot patrol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this was a 10-minute, 15-minute walk away, maximum, you know, practically within sight of the base. So that 100 pounds of fertilizer that had to be buried in the road, you know, was certainly done with the full knowledge of the local villagers.
Yeah.
So and that was a common occurrence, you know. I mean, no one, you know, I was a little bit, it wasn't the first time I've been hit by an IED, but I was a little bit shocked afterwards. And but the Marines were just completely unfazed, you know, it's just another day.
Mm-hmm. And since you have also spent time in Iraq, is there a contrast? Did Iraqi civilians, particularly after 2006, did they tend to want to support the U.S. forces over the insurgents.
Oh, I didn't get that impression much at all either. You know, it's they react the same way we would react. You know, if there were suddenly armed men that we hadn't invited in patrolling our streets that we had nothing sort of culturally or linguistically in common with. So I would say, by and large, you know, the behaviors in Afghanistan and Iraq range from sort of tacit acceptance to outright hostility,
mm-hmm.
and very little in the way of friendliness or helpfulness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and in Afghanistan, one of the things that I see, and I haven't been there, I want to concede that, I'm an armchair observer here, is that it seems almost impossible for us to ultimately win trust in the so-called hearts and minds of civilians, because the Taliban is so pervasive, and they're deadly. And if I were an Afghani looking at American or NATO forces and knowing that behind the bushes and in the woodwork are people who speak my language, who share my faith, and who will kill me or harm me in some way if they think I am a Quisling, a collaborator, it seems to me that that's an intractable chemistry that we can't overcome by building schools and roads and trying to develop a civil society in Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, it's a heady brew, to be sure. And it's more particularly acute in the southern and eastern areas, certainly. And from what I've read and heard, one of the options on the table for the Obama administration is simply conceding the fact that the Taliban are going to have a role in the future of Afghanistan, because the number of troops and the amount of money required to and number of years required to establish a civil society across this vast country, you know, the idea of it is almost incomprehensible. So it is. It's an extraordinarily tough task at hand, and there isn't the sort of societal cohesion and historical cohesion that, say, Iraq had, which allowed the violence to flip very suddenly. Certainly, Al-Qaeda was, their excesses in Iraq really embittered a lot of the Sunni Arab tribes that were, although disparate, united in a certain way that a couple sheikhs could pull them all together. There's no such identity, as far as I can tell, in Afghanistan, where people are living basically in these isolated groups, and you know, if you flip one to your side, there's no guarantee you're going to flip the next. I mean, certainly in places like the east of Afghanistan, where I've also spent some time, you know, you go from one valley to the next. They may only be separated by a couple miles, but they're speaking a different language. You know, they look completely different. They have nothing really in common with one another, and certainly they've been oftentimes fighting one another for many years. Even within the valley, the groups would be fighting one another. So the idea of a Sunni awakening type thing happening in Afghanistan, to me, seems pretty inconceivable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I share that. And give us your timeline, and to what extent were you there when the national elections were held, rife with fraud and ballot box stuffing, at the end of August?
I was there in Afghanistan during the elections. I was there from the beginning of August until the middle of September.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from where we were in Helmand Province in the Garmsir District Center, back to that initial place that was relatively stable and at peace. On every patrol we went on in there, we never were shot at or anything. And there was an independent election observer there, a British guy. He wasn't there the whole day, certainly, only part of the day, with a heavy escort. So there possibly were things going on behind closed doors. But there just wasn't much of a turnout to begin with that would even, you know, who knows if there was fraud. I mean, I certainly didn't see any, but I also barely saw a turnout. I mean, few hundred people showed up.
And what attitudes did you pick up in Helmand toward the Karzai government in Kabul?
People that I talked to in Helmand, I mean, they just felt completely disconnected towards it. They hadn't seen its presence, so it really bore no relationship to their lives. When I was with Dexter, we were on a foot patrol in south of Garmsir, back in this place, Mian Poshte, And Dexter was doing a story about the elections, and so he was asking various villagers, you know, are you going to vote, and what do you think of Karzai? And, you know, to these questions like, are you going to vote, they would just, you know, they would laugh at us. They were the Taliban were all around them. The closest polling station was, I guess it was about 20 kilometers up the road, roads that are, and they don't have cars, certainly, and so it would be this massive walk. They'd be threatened, they were threatened with having their fingers cut off by the Taliban, and of course, you know, possibly worse as well. And they hadn't seen any sign of the government, so the idea of them voting was just like, they thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever heard, really.
Hmm. And when you say funniest, is the whole concept of democracy, you know, strange or amusing to them in a bizarre way?
Well, you know, I think, you know, I don't think so. I think democracy is a very human form of governance. I mean, these remote villages, they basically are run on a democracy on a certain level. The village shura, the village elders, have a council that makes the decisions, and so that's about as democratic as it gets, really. It's essentially representative, so not, as far as I can tell, so terribly different from the type of democracy we're espousing.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the question is more than whether they relate to democracy, more whether they can relate to the idea of a centralized democracy as opposed to just a local one.
Mm-hmm.
And because they've seen no evidence of it in the past, you know, there's this natural wariness towards it.
And what about all the allegations of corruption that Karzai's brother is profiting from the opium trade, the poppy trade, and heroin?
Well, I don't know all the details of it. I can only speak from my experience, but certainly when we got back to Kabul, I was staying at a different place from Dexter, and I got a phone call from him one afternoon saying, hey, you know, you got to get over to this hotel right now, you know, in 5 minutes. And I thought, well, what's going on here? And I got there, and it was a local governor within Kandahar, and Karzai's brother's the governor of Kandahar. It was telling Dexter about how he and his ruling council had been detained by Karzai's brother's men for the entirety of the elections because he promised his vote to Abdullah, and Karzai's brother got wind of it. So that was certainly, you know, that was the one thing I saw with my own eyes, but certainly was a very, those are very difficult accusations, very dangerous accusations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were you surprised, fast-forwarding to the present here at the end of October, that Karzai has agreed to a runoff against Abdullah?
Surprised? Well, not really. I think he really had no choice in the matter. So, you know, he's still beholden to the U.S. I'm sure there was an insane amount of pressure on him. So he did all he could do. I mean, he's a practical guy. He's a good politician in many ways.
Yeah, they sent John Kerry.
John Kerry.
He strung out a bunch of five-syllable words and wouldn't stop until Karzai relented.
Is that right? I didn't hear the exchange, certainly.
Well, I'm
disconnect myself slightly from these events when I get home, just for my own peace of mind.
I can understand that. We're talking with Peter von Ockmail, and he is an independent photojournalist. His work appears in the New York Times. In the magazine, dated October 18th, some very powerful photos. And again, a slideshow that's at the New York Times website. The link is at the podcast information at peterbcollins.com, linked to this podcast to make it easy for you to find it. Peter, you've also published a book with powerful combat photography called Second Tour, Hope I Don't Die. And in your introduction, the prologue, you write, I wanted to make pictures that reflected my complex and often contradictory experiences, where the line was continuously blurred between perpetrator and victim, between hero and villain. In time, the labels that had heretofore defined my perceptions of the world became meaningless. Tell our listeners what you mean by that.
Well, I'll start with the end of the line and work my way to the beginning might even be the most natural way to do it. Basically, you know, all of us, when we're young, we're given a version of the world that we believe in, or it's an implied belief, certainly. And you know, and as you get older and you start maturing and gaining self-awareness and see things. your own eyes, the version of reality that you were taught and the version of reality that you actually perceive and feel is there's a sharp disconnect between those things. And that's one of the reasons I became a photographer, because it allowed me sort of to authentically explore all these questions with a wide range of people in a wide range of places. And in terms of the rest of the line, you know, that this is one of the examples of sort of bucking my expectations. You know, growing up in America, you have where I grew up in the suburbs of D.C., and I went to a private school, and then I went to Yale, and so I was pretty disconnected, to say the least, from the kinds of folks that are generally joining the military. And so I think my perception of the military was a fairly naive one, an ignorant one, frankly. And so when I got there, I met a lot of guys that, you know, I made good friends with and I had a great fondness for and had a lot of respect for. But it was simultaneously difficult to square that with the fact that some of these guys were doing terrible things. You know, some of these guys who I would hang out with and eat with and laugh with back at the base, you know, were causing great violence on other people, and there was a disconnect there. I still haven't quite figured out the sort of duality of man and this capacity that we all have in us for great empathy and great violence.
And talk about how you manage this personally, because I the photojournalists I know have a level of detachment that's a little higher than the average person. At the same time, your photos are so powerful, and the emotion they convey is inescapable, and I can't imagine that you can click that shutter and just park your feelings, somewhere outside your body.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's true, of course. I've had my down days and down weeks and down months, for that matter. After I got back, I was in Iraq about 5 months in 2006, and it was the first time I'd been to war. And you know, basically my worldview as I knew it was shattered into about 1,000 pieces, and I sort of had to figure out how to put all those pieces back together again into something that was recognizable in my own and made sense of those experiences. And so for a long time I was down with trying to just, because I had a lot of questions and really no answers at all. But ultimately, you know, I arrived at a few conclusions that have kept me going in many ways. And one is certainly that I deeply believe in what I do, and I believe in photojournalism, and I believe in mass communication generally. I think they're new technologies, and the collective weight of their testimony over time is going to change the world and help change humanity. And it's maybe a naive belief on a certain level, But no one has the long view, and I'd like to believe in something anyhow. And I see how people are really moved by my pictures a lot of the time, and it gives me confidence to continue.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to continue, I need to keep being connected to these subjects. And so if I wasn't feeling anything, then there'd be no point to me being there at all. So on a certain level, it hasn't been difficult just because I believe so strongly in what I'm doing. You know, I don't need to question it too much. I don't have blood mm-hmm. on my hands. And so I can continue to do it. It doesn't mean that I don't get depressed and unhappy, though, sometimes, certainly, because it is. It's hard to deal with these experiences sometimes.
Sure. Now, Peter, as I look at your photographs in the book and also in the magazine and online, the one thing I don't see is anything about the military contractors. And we know, for example, that in Iraq, there are actually more contractors. They're not all armed Blackwater or Zay fighters, mercenaries. But, there's just a huge contingent of these people who are not members of our military organizations, but are there on a contract basis in support. What are your perceptions of the role of contractors in each of these wars, Iraq and Afghanistan? And to what extent do you consider them part of the American war effort and deserving of coverage?
Oh, I mean, I would love to cover the contractors. They just don't want me to cover them. That's what it all boils down to. So, you know, having never had firsthand experience to form any judgments, you know, I can't really comment too much on that, but certainly I think anyone can read between the lines and what that means. I mean, it is disconcerting, frankly, to not have opportunities to cover their actions in these places. And that's part of the controversy surrounding them. So, yeah, well, as a journalist, you know, I think certainly it's crucial to have the same kind of openness towards those groups as you do towards the military, because the U.S. military allows you to do absolutely anything. You know, it's remarkable how open they are, and I've never been censored, and it's never even been considered seemingly to censor me. So why this other half isn't so open? You know, I have no idea.
And do you feel, you're not an employee of the New York Times, but do you feel that the corporate media is circumscribed in its coverage? And certainly, you know, the Times gave us excellent coverage of the events at Nisour Square and many other of the issues related to the armed military contractors. But in a broader sense, they're not really included as a central part of the story.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the New York Times has done about as good a job as, and I'm not an employee of them, and I work for them. I work for them, you know, because I respect them a lot, and I think they've done a great job covering these wars. Probably actually, I think far and away the best job. And they don't pull punches with the pictures they'll publish. But you know, a lot, sure, as you call it, the corporate media in other forms, it's been very difficult. You know, speaking from my own experience, one of the main reasons to do this book in the first place, and as you've seen, there's some really unsparing images in it.
Indeed.
Because a lot of these meaningful moments, the most meaningful moments, which oftentimes are tied to violence, no one would touch those pictures, you know, with a 10-foot pole, and that was, you know, incredibly discouraging to me, of course, because I thought, how could I go all the way here with, you know, with the military's blessing, return with these pictures, and then the very institution that I believe in, that has a responsibility to disseminate these kinds of images is failing at that. So,
and what about American television? Because they are undercovering these wars, particularly now. There are very few correspondents in the field. They don't even have dedicated bureaus or producers in many cases. And they piggyback on the hard work of print journalists and people from networks from other parts of the world, rather than put their own people into the war zone.
Boy, you know, I don't know much with television, just because I'm not connected to that world. I have very little clue what they're actually doing. I just never watch TV. I do know that I saw a lot of people from CBS News on this last trip to Afghanistan. They had multiple film crews at that point that I was there. And they were going right into the thick of things. You know, Laura Logan, the CBS senior foreign correspondent, came to Mian Poshte, this being the most, you know, one of the most dangerous outposts in Afghanistan. She came there just as Dexter and I were leaving. And you know, she was going out into the field every day. So my brief encounters with TV news have been positive, but frankly, because I don't watch TV, I really have no idea what they're doing the rest of the time.
Peter, in the book Second Tour, Hope I Don't Die, you offer various profiles and some text descriptions of the people in your photographs, and I just want to pick one. There are many brief stories, but you go into some detail about a man named Raymond Hubbard, and he was injured in Baghdad July 4th of 2006, and you tell the story of his return to the U.S. He lost part of his leg below the left knee, and his reintegration with his family and children is something that you cover. Tell us a little bit more about Hubbard.
Well, I met Ray, I guess it was towards the end of 2007, at a documentary screening, of all things, for a movie about veterans called Alive Day Memories, and it was about the day that, the Alive Day, as they call it, the day these guys almost died. And we got to chatting there, and we had a lot in common, and we became pretty fast friends, and he'd never been to New York, and I was going up there the next week, and so brought him up there, and slowly just started, sort of naturally, we didn't even, like, discuss it, I just at some point started photographing him. You know, not that often necessarily, but in the midst of our, you know, our friendship, there were plenty of moments that also seemed worthy of creating sort of a historical record of, and it over time just became a collaboration. And Ray, you know, Ray, he's had a pretty tough time coming home, and it's been a lot of ups and downs. You know, while he's physically largely recovered. He was in a coma for a month after his injury, and he suffered a traumatic brain injury, and so he suffers from depression, and his moods are up and down, and his ability to concentrate has been much compromised by this injury. And so while he now has 100% disability from the Army for the rest of his life, basically allowing him to do whatever he wants, he has a certain amount of, he has a lot of uncertainty, and I think he's drifting because of having this 100% disability means he really doesn't have to do anything at all. So what's important about him and my relationship with him and is he, I think he's symbolic of a lot of these veterans that are coming home, and they're coming home very badly injured, and they're getting the physical support they need, certainly, but I don't think that the military has quite figured out the best way. The military and all these groups that have cropped up for wounded veterans have quite figured out how to support them emotionally, and I think that has a lot to do with just how disconnected our society is from these wars, that so few people have actually encountered them and know what it feels like to fight in them and to feel that fear and to be patrolling these streets. So his problems have become less physical and more sort of emotional at this point, I think because of that disconnect.
And Peter, in a quote that you have from Ray Hubbard in the text here, he describes that his own father was a Vietnam vet who was disabled and spent the rest of his life as a drunk and somebody who was really just getting by and who appeared to scare the hell out of Ray.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I never knew his father. His father committed suicide when Ray was young. Well, I don't, not quite committed suicide, but drank himself to death.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to be Ray's fate. He has two kids, Brady and Riley, who he dotes on and loves and takes good care of. But there is this, of course, there is the fear of this legacy of the Vietnam War continuing for this current generation of veterans that are both wounded in body and mind, because there is not a robust support system.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever key, for me, I've seen a lot at this point. It's been a lot easier for me to pick up the pieces in a sense because I don't have blood on my hands, and I believe what I'm doing is positive and other people believe that. But there's I know that a lot of guys have very conflicted feelings about what they've done, and that manifests itself in a sort of form of paralysis.
Mm-hmm. Peter, I wanted to ask you about one other thing in terms of the troops, and this is more germane, I think, to Iraq than Afghanistan. But Dar Jamil is an independent journalist who published a book earlier this year, and he described that there are some troops who very furtively avoid putting themselves at risk. And so they'll be sent out on patrol, and they've figured out ways to send dummy GPS signals back to their local base, and that essentially they pretend to be on patrol while they're hiding out in a safe haven someplace. And I don't know how widespread this is, but I wanted to see if you had encountered any soldiers who confided in you that they were trying to avoid any greater risk and, in essence, were lying to or deceiving their commanders.
No, I never saw anything like that. Every unit I was with was always doing their prescribed duty, for better or for worse, but they certainly weren't shirking from their responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Peter, can I ask you a couple of technical questions? How many cameras do you carry, and what kind of equipment do you use? How many lenses, and just how burdensome is that when you're out there with combat gear on and concerned about taking fire?
Oh, it's not so bad. I take two camera bodies with me that aren't too big, and two lenses, and that's it. A couple extra batteries and a couple extra compact flashcards. These are digital cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And So, at times, when you're under fire, of course, it's a real pain to have these cameras. I mean, when I was crawling through this cornfield when we were in this firefight, I basically had to grab my cameras, throw them in front of me a few feet, crawl up to them, grab them, throw them in front of me, and crawl up to them. You know, it's not ideal way of keeping taking care of those things. But but yeah, I mean, I travel as light as possible because otherwise, you know, just basically with a backpack and a camera bag because there's no extra room.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you might be having to hike for a lot longer with this gear than you thought possible. So.
Yeah. And when, for example, you got into this situation where the IED went off, I mean, the picture you took shows that you were just a couple of hundred yards away. How do you balance your own need for personal safety with your journalistic instincts to get the picture?
Well, I mean, these things are kind of intertwined at this point. You know, because I've been doing this now for a few years, since the beginning of 2006, you know, I'm more or less, you know, the first thing, of course, is self-preservation like anyone else. And so when that IED went off, you know, within about a second, a series of calculations were made. You know, one, okay, there was this massive explosion, which I was sort of expecting. I mean, I had the feeling something was going to happen, as did, I think, everyone else on the patrol. And so, you know, I hit the deck along with everyone else. You know, it was clear that there was it was a big boom, but no metal or shrapnel flying through the air. So it was clear that it was a fertilizer bomb, which is common in that area. So basically within a second, I got down and I got back up and started taking pictures as I knew I wasn't going to get hit by any flying metal or anything.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what would you like to add for our listeners to appreciate what you have experienced in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Oh, I'd say, you know, not to be too self-promoting, but go buy the book and look at the New York Times piece. I mean, I made that book certainly specifically in opposition to what I thought was a certain amount of sugarcoating of the realities on the ground, and so it's a pretty unsparing view, and I'm proud that I've been able to do it. And so, if people are more interested in seeing independent reality, then they should take a look at it.
And the book is out in soft cover. It's called Second Tour: Hope I Don't Die. It's from Photo Lucida. And you should be able to find it at Amazon, perhaps at your independent bookstore locally. Peter von Agtmael, Agtmael. A real pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining
Great
us today.
To you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this brief episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. I wanted to get the comments of photographer Peter von Agtmael out immediately, so we'll release this podcast without an additional segment. And I think we're going to give Roy Rogers, Trigger, and the Happy Trail song a little break today. Because as we approach the end of October, I would like to find room to put this song out. It's a title track from what I think was the second U2 release in the United States. And it's simply called October. Thanks for listening. Drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.